I was just told that I have to keep some people awake this morning because we're getting tireder as the week goes by. And I sympathize with that. I'm getting tireder too, but I really feel that for the hosts because they're working pretty hard to take care of all the rest of us and make sure everything flows along. And it gets to be, well, it gets to be tiring, doesn't it? We're talking about the Table of Nations in the 10th chapter of Genesis. Yesterday we took a little side trip to the sub-theme there of the Tower of Babel, because what that explains is where the various languages of mankind originated, which we have reference to over and over again with the sons of Noah in the 10th chapter of Genesis, that the sons of Japheth in the 5th verse of chapter 10, as they were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. This great separation occurred because of what happened at the Tower of Babel, because of God putting the brakes on as humankind was going down the path of staying together and engaging in rebellion, in making progress that God was not willing for them to make quite so quickly. God had a plan, and God, when command, that is telling them to fill the earth, was not sufficient to stir the pot, then God stirred the pot in another way with the confusion of languages. And I can only imagine what kind of confusion that brought about. In fact, I never had really thought about that too much until I read a novel by C.S. Lewis called The Hideous Strength, I guess it is. That Hideous Strength is the third novel of a trilogy he wrote. And he describes a scene like this. And he described it very, very effectively. And I read it way back in my college days. But it made me really think about what would happen if you had a lot of people working together who suddenly could not communicate with one another, who suddenly had this kind of event occur. And as far as everyone is concerned, it's everybody else's problem. What's wrong with them? Why have they suddenly become like this? Why have they changed like this? And it would result not only in people going different directions because they couldn't talk to each other, but people going in different directions because they couldn't trust each other. They weren't just sure what was going on. You know how you feel when people are talking around you in a different language and you wonder, what are they saying and are they talking about me and just what's going on here? And there had to be some pretty good conspiracy theories that came out of the incident there at Babel to entertain the children with for generations to come. Going back into the 10th chapter of Genesis again this morning, we're picking up at verse 6 with the sons of Ham. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. Now, there is a land in the Bible that is identified as the land of Ham. Does anyone know what that is? Well, it's in Psalm 105 and verse 23, and it's a reference to Egypt. Egypt is referred to as the land of Ham, and that may be because that's where Ham himself went to settle. But one of his sons here is especially associated with the land of Egypt. It's the second son of Ham. His name is Mizraim. And if you go to the land of Egypt today and see signs that are in the, well, English alphabet anyway, you'll find this name on the signs because that's the Arabic name for Egypt. That's the Hebrew name for Egypt. It's the ancient name of Egypt in those languages. The Egyptians themselves, in their own tongue, had a different name. They called their land Kemi, and that name, K-E-M-I, is probably derived from the name Ham itself. But at any rate, Ham, the land of Ham, is, biblically speaking, the land of Ham is the land of Egypt. We have the first of Ham's sons here being mentioned is Cush, and Cush is identified in the Bible very strongly with the land of Ethiopia. Ethiopia is called Cush. That's the Hebrew name, the biblical name for the land of Ethiopia. So what region are we connecting with Ham and the descendants of Ham at this point?
North Africa.
Okay, North Africa. And in fact, as we go down through the descendants of Ham here and some of the other names, we also find the ancestor of the Lydians, which is also North Africa, and pretty much on across North Africa there. And why not the rest of Africa? Well, because as they moved on and migrated away, Shem doesn't have track of them anymore. The Semites are no longer in contact with them, and we don't have those connections anymore. But at any rate, the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And we associate the name Canaan, of course, with what? The land of Canaan, the land of promise, the land that becomes the land of Israel, the land that God had promised to Abraham. And at the time when God promised it to Abraham, it's already called the land of Canaan. That's the name that's attached to the land. And when Abraham goes there, we're told that the Canaanites were in the land, which is not a big surprise since it's called the land of Canaan, but the Canaanites were in the land when Abraham came there. So we have in this sixth verse, the sons of Ham were Cush. That refers to Ethiopia. Ham himself is directly connected with Egypt, and the name for Egypt is Mizraim, this son of Ham. Put is connected with Lydia, and Canaan, of course, with the land of Canaan. We go on, we have the sons of Cush, and I'm not going to spend very much time on these. Seba is connected with southwestern Arabia, the Sudan and the Sabaean people. We don't know about some of these sons of Ham exactly who to associate them with. But we come to the eighth verse, and we're told that Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. Cush begot Nimrod, he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Anybody here ever been called a Nimrod? I used to run around with a BB gun, and my grandma or somebody or other would say something about being a Nimrod. What's a Nimrod? A hunter, right? Is that what this means? Oh, Steve is shaking his head and saying no.
Modern usage, it means somebody that's not too smart.
Modern usage, someone who's not too smart. Well, thanks. I think actually it has come to mean someone who's kind of naive, kind of doesn't know their way around. I think it's come to have that sort of a meaning. I don't know just why, unless that's, never mind. I'm going to get off on a political tangent here about hunting and all that kind of stuff. The term has been used in that sort of a frivolous way. But when it says that Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord, do you think that's a compliment?
No.
It's not intended as a compliment. That's not presented here as a compliment. It certainly is saying that he was a powerful man, but it's not saying that he got there in a good way. In fact, when it says before the Lord, that could very well be rendered against the Lord, that he was doing his best to overturn and to thwart the plans of God, that he was in rebellion. In fact, some of you already know, what does the name Nimrod mean? He who rebels, or let us rebel. The name Nimrod means he who rebels. Now, either his father Cush, had an anticipation, or maybe even a plan, maybe he had a design for his son, or else Nimrod took that name to himself, and I am kind of inclined in that direction myself, to think that in his pride, in his arrogance, that he may have taken that name to himself as a sort of a title, description of who he saw himself as being. Or it may be that that was a name ascribed to him by reputation. There's no way to really know for sure. I can't say that a father wouldn't name his son the rebel. I can't, because people name their children all kinds of things. And I don't always understand why people give their children the names that they do. But his father could have given him that name. But I have a notion that his name came about because of what he himself did and became rather than the other way around. And there's no way of establishing that with certainty one way or the other. But when it says that he began to be a mighty one on the earth there in the eighth verse, that's a little bit of a reminder of a phrase back in the sixth chapter, Genesis 6 and 4. When it says there were giants, and I don't really care for the word giants in King James or New King James, the Nephilim, mighty ones, these extraordinary people were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came to the daughters of men and they had children by them, those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. There's nothing supernatural going on in that verse. This is all about interaction of different groups of humans and some people being bigger, stronger, more powerful than other people. But they were mighty men in the earth in those days. And here Nimrod, he begins to be a mighty one. This is a reflection back on some of the troublesome things that were going on before the flood. Here in the family of Ham, Nimrod, the son of Cush, Ham's grandson, he's beginning to be one of those kind of people, one of those mighty ones who accrued power to themselves and were responsible for the violence that filled the earth and so forth. And he was, as it says, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And that may reflect on the fact that these were wild times in the world. Maybe he literally hunted animals, wild beasts. There's a lot of that kind of heritage in the royalty of the ancient world, you know, depictions of kings riding out in chariots with spear in hand, pursuing the lion and other wild beasts. And it may be that he built a reputation with that sort of manliness, that sort of going out and showing how powerful he was, how strong he was, what a great hunter he was. Or it may be, as some have interpreted, that the mighty hunter refers to the way he treated other people, that he was very aggressive and very violent in his treatment of other people. We don't know for certain exactly what the original writer had in mind here with describing him that way, but he's pictured as an aggressive and violent individual at any rate. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, or the mighty hunter against the Lord. He is in conflict with God. He is before the face of God, but not in a positive way. He is in the way of rebellion. And the beginning of his kingdom, verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. What did we read about Babel yesterday? Well, we read that Babel is the place where they came together with the idea, let's stay together, and in order to accomplish that, let's build a great city, and let's build a tower into heaven. And what happened to that activity, that effort, that purpose? It was abandoned. It was thwarted by God, and that effort came to naught. But if Babel was the beginning of his kingdom, did that dissuade Nimrod? Just because God intervened and messed it up, did that dissuade him? You see, as I read this, Babel failed, but Nimrod didn't give up. Babel didn't accomplish the result. So he did what he could to pick up the pieces and build an empire out of the results of that. That's what I think I see happening here. If Babel was the beginning of his kingdom, then he went from trying to build a kingdom through consensus to building a kingdom through conquest. If he couldn't have everybody agree with him, then he would take the road that many a later conqueror took and impose his will, his language, his culture on the other people and the things that they were doing. And so we go and along here and we see that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and then we have Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. And we don't know where all of these cities were, but we do know where Calneh was, we do know where Erech was. We do know where Babel was because, of course, it flourished later, in later generations, as the city of Babylon. In the land of Shinar, the Sumerian epoch here, the time of the kingdom of Sumer. Now, Erech is known to us in another ancient story. It's spelled a little bit differently. It's spelled with U instead of E in the Sumerian language. But Uruk, which is the city where a character named Gilgamesh was from. There's the epic story of Gilgamesh, a mythological story of a man who was very powerful, very cruel. He ruled over the city of Erech, and he ruled it with an iron fist. He was able to overcome other men in conflict. He was reputed to have the strength of, I don't remember if it was 100 men or 1,000 men, but he was one of those mythical characters who was so much more powerful than all of his contemporaries. Among the things that were told about him is that, you know, no daughter of any mother was safe and no wife of any warrior was safe. He was a tremendous womanizer. And a part of the story, he's on his way to a wedding. And he's going to the wedding because he gets the first night with the bride and then the husband gets the second night with the bride. This is the kind of king that Gilgamesh was. Now, some people have tried to connect Nimrod with Gilgamesh. I think it's pretty scanty. I don't know whether there's a legitimate connection or not. Nimrod ruled over Erech and Gilgamesh was a king of Erech, but I'm not at all sure that you can correlate that into an equivalency. But it says something, I think the story says something of the spirit of kingship in this era. When we talk about the kings of Israel, and this is a factor in the story that John has been sharing with us about Hosea and the background he's been giving in the book of Hosea. When we talk about the kings of Israel, what were the kings of Israel supposed to be subject to? They're supposed to be subject to the law of God. That the book of Deuteronomy says that when a king, when he becomes king, one of the first things that he is to do is to sit down and make his own copy. He's to hand copy the law, and he himself is to be subject to that law. The Israelites, see, this is what America adopted, is that we would be a land of law, that everyone, high and low, would be under the same law. Now, does that always work? No. If you've got a lot of money, you can, you know, work your way around a lot of things. If you got political power, but the idea of everyone being subject to the same law, that's an Israelite idea. That's a Mosaic idea. That was the idea that David was subject to the same law that Uriah was subject to. That everyone is subject to the same law from the highest to the lowest. And that's why the prophets can confront the kings and say you're wrong and you need to change and you need to do differently because God holds you accountable and the people and the priests and everybody else ought to hold you accountable as well. Whether you're a king, whether you're a priest, whether you're any commoner, you're subject to the same law. But the kingdoms of the rest of the world, by and large, didn't work that way. And we see that in the story of Gilgamesh, and I think it probably illustrates the sort of king, the sort of ruler that Nimrod would have been, indeed, that it's all about the king, that the king has absolute power, and what the king wants to do, he does. That's one of the differences between Ahab and Jezebel. Ahab has the Israelite heritage, even if he is an evil man, and when he wants to possess the vineyard of Naboth, and Naboth says no, he feels thwarted, and he goes and he pouts. He feels like, well, there's nothing I can do. He won't sell me the vineyard. And Jezebel says, that's no way for a king to act, because her idea is a king gets what a king wants. If a king wants the vineyard, the king can have the vineyard, and she arranges for the king to have the vineyard. But she's coming from a Phoenician background. And by the way, what family of Noah do the Phoenicians come from? Anybody? Not Japheth. They come from Ham, right? Sidon is one of the children of Ham, and that's the first city of the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians are Hamites. In fact, just as a generalization, the earliest, greatest civilizations on planet Earth, they're all Hamite. All of them are from the family of Ham. Whether we're talking about Egypt, whether we're talking... What?
You said Sidon was the son of Ham?
I did say that. Am I wrong? It's a grandson. It's not a son of Ham, but it is a grandson of Ham. Did I get that wrong?
No, you got it wrong.
It's in verse 15, isn't it? Canaan begot Sidon?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. No, I know. I'm jumping ahead. And that was because I was talking about Jezebel and talking about the Phoenicians. But the Phoenicians, their first home base, their first great port is the port of Sidon, named after this grandson of Ham. And that Phoenician empire that prowled the Mediterranean for 1,000 years or so, actually a little more than that, was Hamite. And so, of course, was the Egyptian Empire Hamite. And so, of course, was the Hittite Empire Hamite. And if we follow through on some of these names, there's a pretty good reason to think that the Chinese and the Mesoamericans were also of Hamite descent. The great pyramid builders of the continents of the world pretty much seem to have been of the Hamites, of the family of Ham. When I believe it was Isaac Newton, and probably someone here could correct me if I'm wrong. I think Isaac Newton said something to the effect that if I have reached higher than others who've gone before me, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants. Didn't he say something pretty close to that? That he looked at the people on whose shoulders, on whose work he was building his ideas, and gave appropriate credit. And realistically, for the world of Shem and Japheth to give credit where credit is due, a great deal of what's been accomplished in human civilization rests on the shoulders of what the descendants of Ham did, for good or bad. They were the early civilization builders. They were the early empire builders. They were the early technological achievers in many, many areas. And the later civilizations of Greece and Rome are built on the shoulders of what had been done by the Hamite civilizations that preceded them. And we are the heirs, on down the line, of the benefits that are accrued from those accomplishments, as well as the deficits accrued from some of those accomplishments. It's not the kind of civilization building that has taken place in this world has not by any means all been to the good. We have, though, that I'm coming back around to Nimrod. Nimrod was a despot. There's every reason to see him being pictured here as a tyrant, a despot, a conqueror. And some of the places that he is listed as ruling over are not at all going to be Hamite places. They're going to be places that were established by Semites. They're going to be cities that were built by others. And he built his empire by taking what others had already built, by conquest and by usurping authority over them. From that land he went to Assyria, or Asshur, and built Nineveh. But Asher is of the family of Shem. So he went and into the Semite region, the area. And again, this is post-Babel, as I read it, because Babel was the beginning of his kingdom, that he went into where some of the Semites, the family of Asher, had settled, and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. That is the principal city. And again, several of these are known to us archaeologically. Some of them were for a long time lost to history, lost to sight, including the great city of Nineveh itself. But several of these are known to us in the modern era because of the explorations of the 19th and 20th centuries. And some of these cities, including Calah, actually retain the name of Nimrod in association with them. At least three of these cities in Iraq, in what is modern-day Iraq, at least three of those cities have the name Nimrod attached to them, only it's spelled with a U instead of an O, N-I-M-R-U-D, the name Nimrud, attached to them as a remembrance. This man became a great hero. For generations, for millennia, this man was regarded as a great hero because of his accomplishments. And, last night I was in Excelsior Springs and I crossed a street. And from my perspective, it was an odd name for a street. It was Jesse James Street or Road. What was that? Who was he? You know? He was an outlaw. He was a bank robber. He was a murderer. He was a thief. And yet, you know, he's a hero? How does that play? Well, Nimrod was a hero in the eyes of a lot of people. He was a villain in the eyes of the people that he oppressed. But nevertheless, he was a hero and a legendary figure in the eyes of a lot of people. And that's reflected in the fact that there are cities that bear his name to this day over in that region of the world. So the sons of Ham, we had here that Ham... Again, we got Cush, and then we have his second son, Mizraim, in verse 13. And Mizraim, again, is what country? Egypt. All right. Mizraim begot Ludim, Anamim, Liabim, Naphtuhim, Pathrusim, and Kashluhim, from whom came the Philistines and Kaphtorim. We don't know much about some of those names, because some of those names refer to people who probably just blended into the ethnic homogeny of the land of Egypt over time. And we don't particularly know anything historically about some of those names. But when we come to this one in verse 14, that from Mizraim, through Mizraim, the son of Ham, we have the Kashulim, from whom come the Philistines, and Kaphtorim. And there's a name that we know, right? The Philistines. We recognize the name of the Philistines and realize that they have a lot to do with the history of the biblical story, the events that take place in the days of the judges, in the days of the early kings of Israel. The Philistines are associated in Amos 9:7. And in Jeremiah 47:4 with the Kaphtorim, just as they are here. And the best identification for what we're talking about here is the island of Crete. The Philistines, Kaphtor is Crete, the Philistines initially settled in Crete, and from Crete eventually spread to the coastlands of Canaan, the area between Egypt and Canaan there, the southern coastal region of the land of Canaan. In the book of Genesis, we have Abraham moving around in Philistine territory a little bit. And whenever I read the stories of Abraham's interaction with those people, it sounds to me, as indeed some of the other things in Abraham, it sounds very legitimate to me for one thing. It seems like he is dealing with what amounts to a very low ebb of culture. These are not great cities and powerful people at the time when Abraham is moving through that land. It's rather, it seems like a rather penny-ante kind of a civilization that he's dealing with. They're bothered by him, and they're bothered by his flocks and herds and his apparent power, and they'd like him to stay at some distance because they're disturbed about the impact that he may have on their land. And when Isaac is in that same area, they try and discourage Isaac from staying around by filling in wells and trying to basically get him to move further away. Because they're uncomfortable with his presence. It doesn't sound like there is a powerful people there in the days of Abraham and Isaac. And in fact, it looks like from archaeological records and comparative records of Egyptians and others that the Philistines really became a great power on the Mediterranean coast there sometime in the mid to late second millennium BC, in about the same time frame as the Exodus and the Judges. And exactly why that happened is not completely clear. They had been a part of, apparently, the Mycenaean culture, the culture that influenced the rise of Greece, yes?
You were talking about the Philistines and the kaftorim. In Hebrew, the word kaftor means button.
Means what?
Button. And maybe that came from the fact that the Cretans were kaftorim. Like Crete looks like a button.
Okay. It may well be. I certainly can't in any way refute that. I have no idea. Names come from stranger origins than that. Okay. The Philistines are pictured for us, though, as being of significant power at the time when the Israelites come out of Egypt. God says, I don't want to take them by the way of the Philistines because they'll get discouraged when they see the fighting that they have to do to go that way. And so we'll take them around by the desert and bring them up through the south rather than going by the coast by the easiest route and confronting the Philistines too soon. And later, of course, in the stories of the Judges, we have the Philistines oppressing Israel at different periods, and especially in the days of Samson, the Philistine oppression was extensive in the south in the land of Judah, so much so that God doesn't say Samson is going to deliver Israel from the Philistines. He says Samson is going to begin the deliverance of Israel from the Philistines. He's going to start that, but it was actually going to take several generations before the Israelites were really up to the task, not only technologically and numerically, but up to the task spiritually and emotionally to take on the Philistines. In the days of Samson, they didn't particularly want to. When you read about how the men of Judah reacted to Samson's conflict with the Philistines, they basically wanted him to stop it and go home. And they were willing to bind him and turn him over to the Philistines because they said, you're stirring up trouble. Don't you know the Philistines rule over us and you're making trouble? And they didn't want to deal with it. They didn't want to rebel against the Philistines. They were perfectly happy to pay tribute to the Philistines and let the Philistines have the upper hand. In thinking about the Philistines, sometimes, and I think it largely comes out of a sort of a twist on what is turned into a children's story, the story of David and Goliath, but sometimes the word Philistine has been used in a derogatory way. This kind of goes back to the coffee shop culture of the late 50s and early 60s. But to call someone a Philistine was to call someone illiterate and uncultured. To say that they were a nittering nabob. That's like a Nimrod, isn't it? No, anyway. To call someone a Philistine was a put-down, was to suggest that they were of low culture. And just the opposite is true, biblically and archaeologically. Just the opposite is true. If we look at Philistine culture and Israelite culture, it was the Philistines who had the superior technology. It was the Philistines who had the superior ability. Say, what was that? The metal. The metalworking is one of those things. 1 Samuel, the 13th chapter, verses 19 and following, when Saul became king in Israel. How many swords did all the Israelites have among them when Saul became king? Well, Saul had one and Jonathan had one, and that was it. Because all the blacksmiths were in Philistia. The Philistines did not allow. And the Philistines had that because of their involvement with the Mycenaean culture, their involvement with the Anatolian culture, with the Hittites, where ironworking originally developed. And they had brought that with them. It hadn't developed in Canaan. The Israelites didn't have that technology. The Philistines were ahead of them in that regard. And so the Philistines controlled that technology. They had arms control. You know, they were able to prevent the Israelites from having effective weapons. And the Israelites are out fighting the Philistines. The Philistines have chariots of iron, and the Philistines have armor with iron incorporated into it, and the Philistines have weapons of iron. And the Israelites are out here with farming implements. And they couldn't even sharpen those themselves. They had to go to the Philistines to get them sharpened. And that account in 1 Samuel 13, 19 and following tells how much it costs to get a sickle sharpened, you know, because the Philistines had total control of that technology. And it took the hand of God, and it took willing and effective leadership. And Saul almost lived up to that, but he got distracted because of his jealousy. And finally, it took David to bring that to a climax and finally really overcome the Philistines and subject them to tribute rather than vice versa. But when we look at the Philistines, in most of the stories where we encounter them, the Philistines have the upper hand. These Hamites have the upper hand technologically. They are culturally more sophisticated. There are, you know, hillbillies in the story, but it's not the Philistines of the coast. It's the Israelites of the hills who are the hillbillies in those stories, who are the backward ones, who are the ones who don't have the more sophisticated. And that's one of the reasons, too, why Samson was so fascinated with the Philistines. They were a lot more interesting to hang around with than Israelites were, because look at all the cool technology they had, and look at all of the interesting things that they were doing as compared with the Israelites. Israelites were boring compared with the Philistines, and the Philistine women were obviously more exciting to him. And this is a sort of indication of the progression of the Hamite cultures and Hamite technology in general, I think. Go ahead.
It was mostly arms control. Because they knew how to work with metal.
The Israelites? Are you referring back to an earlier generation when they came out of mm-hmm. Egypt? Yeah. But they didn't necessarily retain that after a few generations in Canaan. And working with gold and silver and brass is considerably different than working with iron.
Yeah, the reference you gave, there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears. Mm-hmm. Sounds like they had the control.
The Philistines had control, yes.
They had the control.
Right. And if I didn't say that clearly before, that's certainly what I meant to say. The Philistines had the control of that technology. Okay? All right. We have the Philistines in verse 14 coming. They originally on the island of Crete, apparently, there seems to have been some sort of upheaval that disrupted that culture. It may have been natural in nature, may have been volcanic upheaval, something along those lines, that caused them to come down into the coasts of Israel there. We have verse 15, then Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn. I've already referenced that indirectly, but Sidon is the father of the Phoenician people, the city of Sidon. And by the way, the fact that it mentions Sidon here is an indication of the antiquity of this text, because what does it not mention? Tyre. It doesn't mention Tyre. Tyre is a younger city than Sidon, and Tyre is not mentioned here, and if it had been in existence at the time this was written, it certainly would have been included in the list. But Tyre wasn't there yet at the time when this list was made. But Sidon was, and of course the Phoenicians became a great trading power all through the Mediterranean, a very influential culture. And they enter into our Bible story especially in a couple of ways. One is the building of Solomon's temple, where Solomon had this relationship with Hiram, the king of Tyre, and got a lot of his materials from him, as well as getting workmen from him, skilled workmen from him, for the building of the temple. And, of course, we see Sidon influencing Israel in other ways, particularly in terms of idolatry, most obviously in the story of Ahab and Jezebel, Jezebel being the daughter of the king of Sidon. But the Phoenicians had a big influence on Israel, especially in the kingdom days. The Phoenicians had a big influence on Israel. And in fact, if you look at royal inscriptions from the days of the kings, even Hezekiah, if you look at a little amulet from the days of Hezekiah, a royal seal, the symbols that are on that seal look very Phoenician. There's a lot of interaction between those two cultures, the Israelite and the Phoenician cultures. A lot of influence from these sons of Ham. But Sidon is a son of Canaan. And Canaan is, I guess you might say, the most influential, biblically speaking. He is the most influential of the sons of Ham. Sidon, his firstborn in Heth, and it has been mentioned, and I'm not going to dwell on them, but it has been mentioned already that Heth is the father of the Hittites, which was a great empire up further north. If you have the little map, it is indicated on the map, the Hittites there in Turkey. In a very remote and difficult region is where they built their capital city, and it all seems very bizarre to me, unless pride is a huge part of the equation. But I'm sure pride was a huge part of the equation in the building of the capital city of the Hittites. But they dominated a good deal of that part of the world, of the Fertile Crescent region, during the second millennium BC, and they were a superpower in conflict with Egypt, and there's correspondence between those two great empires about their differences and about battles that they fought and lands that they controlled. But the Hittites, again, are of the children of Canaan, and we find them frequently mentioned. In the story of Abraham, not only does it say the Canaanites were in the land in those days, it also says the Hittites were in the land in those days. And when we come to the story of King David, David had Hittites in his army. Who's the most notable Hittite in the army of King David?
Uriah.
Uriah the Hittite, who was married to a lovely young lady named Bathsheba. And we know how David handled that particular situation. But David had a multicultural kingdom. In many ways, he had people from a number of different cultural and ethnic backgrounds involved, included in his kingdom in very influential positions, and including Hittites. Uriah was one of the loyal followers of David, Uriah the Hittite. We also then go on, we have the Jebusite, the Amorite, and the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, and the Sinite, the Arvidite, the Zimmerite, and the Hamathite. Afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed, but we have them settling into the land of Canaan, and six of these names turn up over and over and over again in reference to the land of Israel. Six of these names are repeated to us again and again in the promises. It starts in Exodus, the third chapter, and I think it's the fifth verse, but my writing is a little obscure on that at the moment. Anyway, Moses is told by God that I'm going to give you the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And over again, that list of six people is repeated. But there's one name on that list that isn't listed here, and that's the Perizzites. The Perizzites are not listed here. In fact, the origin of the Perizzites isn't listed anywhere. I suppose they are Canaanites. Some people have thought that maybe it referred to a particular subgroup of people that lived in unwalled towns and villages. But the problem is they are referred to as a nation in the in the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1, we're told that there are seven nations that Israel was going to displace in Canaan. Seven nations, including the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, that they are going to displace these seven nations in the land of Canaan. So the Perizzites are a nation, and I would assume that they are descended from someone in the Canaanite family, but they are not otherwise attributed, so we don't know with certainty about that. But the rest of those people that are listed over and over and over again are clearly the descendants of Canaan. They are definitely identified with the family tree of Canaan. And then there are some other sons of Canaan who are listed here who are not included in that list that the Israelites were going to have to deal with. And some of them, somewhat speculatively, may be identified with other peoples in other places in the world. Somewhere in that list was the Sinites, and I'm not my eyes isn't falling on that. Where is that?
17.
All right. The Hivite, the Arkite, and the Sinite. And some people think that that name Sinite may be associated with places like the wilderness of Sin that the Israelites came to, maybe associated with Mount Sinai, maybe associated with Sinim in the Bible, and also think that it may be associated with an ancient name for China. Have you ever seen the S-I-N-O in reference to China? It's a regular abbreviation for referring to China. And the S-I-N-O, that's an ancient name for China, and some people think that that is connected to this name of a son of Canaan named Sin, who fathered the Sinite people, who were the ones who moved eastward into China. And that may be the case. I don't have anything better to offer for the origin of the Chinese people. It very, very well may be the case. And if so, then Canaan is also the ancestor of most of the population that came to inhabit the Americas in ancient times, because those Mongoloid peoples moved up north and across and down. That's not the only people who came to the Americas, but that's the dominant race that we have in the Americas at that time. We have a question or a comment, one or the other.
Yeah, the Hebrew word for Chinese is sin.
Sin?
Sin. Sin.
Yeah. And it may very well be related to this Hebrew name, to the name that we have here in the text. That's not provable beyond a shadow of a doubt, but it's at least a likely possibility that the Canaanites or the children of Canaan are the ancestral origin of the Asian people, and through them the American Indian people, who again were builders, you know, of great civilizations in Mesoamerica, South America, Central America, Mexico, and so forth. I want to talk a little bit more about a few of these descendants of Ham, But I want to take a sidestep for a moment. See how long a moment it takes. I want to take a sidestep for a moment into Genesis 14 and 18. Abraham had been out to a battle and had overcome some kings who had been raiding in the area of Sodom and Gomorrah, that region of the plains. And Abraham had won the battle and had freed the captives and had obtained the spoils of war that had been previously carried away. And he was going back down to the south. And verse 17, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Verse 18, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. And that, you know, comes up in Ellie's class next week, probably, in the seventh chapter of the book of Hebrews, where we have a correlation drawn between Jesus and Melchizedek. And the writer of Hebrews makes much of the fact that Abraham, in this story, paid tithes to Melchizedek, and Melchizedek, in this story, blessed Abraham. And he says, now who blesses whom? Well, the greater blesses the lesser. So Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. Now, there's nothing mystical about Melchizedek because the writer of Hebrews talks about his origin being unknown. We don't have father or mother listed for him. But he says, every priest is chosen from among men. And so I have no doubt that Melchizedek is a man because every priest is chosen from among men. You can't have an angel being a priest of humankind here. This has to be a man. But Melchizedek is a priest of God Most High, and he is in Salem. And what is Salem? Jerusalem. All right, what does the name Salem mean?
Peace.
All right, and Melchizedek is referred to there in the seventh chapter of Hebrews as the King of Peace, because he is King of Salem. And that was anticipating Jesus being also King of Peace. If we don't know the identification of Salem with Jerusalem, we could look at Psalm 76 and 2, which refers to Zion as Salem. In Psalm 76 and verse 2, the psalmist correlates for us Zion and Salem. In Salem also is his tabernacle and his dwelling place in Zion. So the psalmist connects Salem and Zion. And then in 1 Chronicles chapter 11 and verse 4, we have in the story of David taking the city of Jerusalem, 1 Chronicles 11 and 4. David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. And the city of Jebus, in the hands of the Jebusites, was there in a very central place in Israel. And what did David want that city for? He wanted it for his capital city. He wanted it to be in a location that would serve Judah and show Judah he wasn't abandoning them, but would also serve Israel, and so that he wasn't showing preference to the southern part of the kingdom where he had already reigned for where he had already reigned for 7 years. So David picks this as the site of his capital city. Jerusalem is Salem. Jerusalem is Zion. Zion is Salem. Jerusalem is Jebus, the city of the Jebusites. All right. It is in Judges chapter 19, verses 10 and 11. We have Jerusalem specifically identified as a Jebusite city. A Jebusite city. Also, in Joshua chapter 10 and verse 1, Joshua 10 and 1. This is the story of the attack on the Gibeonites. If you remember, the Gibeonites had made a treaty with the Israelites under false pretenses. And then the Gibeonites were attacked by their neighbors because their neighbors didn't like the idea of Gibeon being allied with Israel. And so the Israelites had to go to the rescue of the Gibeonites. Anyway, chapter 10, verse 1 of the book of Joshua. It came to pass when Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai. Okay, so who's the king of Jerusalem here? Adonizedek, all right? Who was the king of Salem in Abraham's day? Melchizedek, all right? What does Melchizedek mean? Melchizedek means, we knew it a minute ago, what is it? Okay, I didn't ask that right. He was the king of Salem, which is the king of peace, and I didn't ask what Melchizedek is. What does it mean? Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Okay, Melchizedek means king of righteousness. So what does Adonizedek mean? Lord of righteousness or righteous Lord. All right, Adonizedek means Lord of righteousness or righteous Lord. Melchizedek is king. Melchi is king. Adonai is Lord. Zedek is righteousness or righteous. So I think it's intriguing, all right? I think it's intriguing that in the days of Abraham, there is a king of Salem, which is Jebus, which is Jerusalem, which is Zion. There's a king of Salem in the days of Abraham whose name is Melchizedek. There is a king of Jerusalem in the days of Joshua whose name is Adonizedek, which sounds a little bit like to me that there's a tradition of king naming that goes on in the city of Jerusalem. And there's continuity from the days of Abraham to the days of Joshua. There's some continuity going on here. And what I'm coming around to is that, you know, in talking about the Hamites, it's easy to talk about a lot of negative things. But who must Melchizedek have been? Well, he certainly was a believer in God. Ethnically, who must he have been? He must have been a Hamite. I don't see how he could have not been a Hamite if he was the king of Salem, which is Jebus, which is the city of the Jebusites. There's not a lot of land attributed to the Jebusites. In the Tel El Amarna letters, there is a name given to the king of Jebus, which the scholars say is a Hittite name, but the Hittites are Hamites too. So even if you look at, even if you go there, you still have a Hamite in charge, in control of the city of Jerusalem during the latter part of the second millennium B.C. But I just found it a little bit intriguing to think about. No, I don't know who the father and mother of Melchizedek were, but I have a pretty good idea that they were Canaanites, that they were of the family of Canaan, in fact, of the family of Jebus, the Jebusites, and the descendants of Ham. And when Abraham comes to Salem, and this man comes out to meet him bringing wine and bread, which always those things make me think, huh, is there something messianic going on here? And Abraham does him honor. Here it seems to be a Hamite who is a righteous man, a godly man, a leader of his people, and that doesn't completely die out among the Hamites. It doesn't completely die out among the Canaanites. We have, for example, the harlot of Jericho who believes in the God of Israel. We have the people of Gibeon who believe in the God of Israel. Now, maybe they could have handled their treaty with Israel a little bit differently, but we have Canaanites, Hamites, who continue to believe, and some of them, you know, on the basis of more recent stories than the ancient flood story and so forth. But we have these people of the family of Ham, some of them like Nimrod, but some of them also like Melchizedek. It's not all painted one way. It's not that all of these people went haywire and went AWOL and rebelled against God. There were righteous people among the Hamites. Even by the time we have Israel coming into the land, they no longer had a standard of righteousness, but they still knew who God was. That El, who was the chief deity of the Canaanite pantheon, was a remembrance of El, Elohim, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, whom they had at one time known. In the days of Melchizedek, they knew him. In the days of Abraham, many of the people of the land knew him. The Canaanite and the Hittite in the land, many of them knew him, or at least knew of him, and some of them served him. That was a vanishing knowledge as the generations went by. Does anyone else have a question or comment this morning that they'd like to share?
I don't know. I was just wondering if you had heard of the theory that Nimrod was the origin of the myth of Marduk.
Yes, and in fact, that's in my notes, and I just kind of forgot to bring it up. But if you look at the name Nimrod, the consonants M-R-D, and you look at the name Marduk, and you remember that in a lot of these ancient languages, you didn't have all the vowels recorded or even any of the vowels. There's a pretty strong identification between the name Nimrod and the name Marduk, and it may very well be that Nimrod is the forebear, the legendary figure that the god Marduk of the Babylonians, the chief deity of the Babylonians, is based on. Can't know that for sure, but it's a possibility. Okay?
Yeah, this doesn't really pertain to much, but I was just, on Wendy's question, I was just curious, did they even have map makers back then where they would have been able to notice the outline of the island or whatever? Or was that something that came later on, map making?
Well, I would have to say that they had map makers back then. They didn't certainly have the kind of cartography that we have today with aerial views and all that. They had to go on the basis of what they could observe about shorelines or see from high places, mountains and so forth. But certainly they did have map makers as far back as we can go in antiquity, people sketching places they'd been and so forth. But as to a specific answer to your question, would they appreciate the shape like that? I don't know. Anyone else? They may also have had buttons, yes. No, they were not. Tying things was much more common, yes. Okay, but they stood on the show. Oh, anyway, go ahead, Steve.
Barry Fell, in his book, America BC, associates or shows pretty strong cases for Phoenician, Egyptian, Libyan, many influences in the Americas in ancient times.
Yeah, a lot of that used to seem wildly speculative, but in fact there have been very good indications of visits to the Americas by people from Australia, people from the Polynesian Islands, people from Asia, not only by some land bridge or other, but by boat, as well as Nordic peoples, as well as people from Africa. The Americas were hit many, many, many times before Columbus, and that's not really weird anymore to think that's true. There's an abundance of evidence, including genetic evidence in some of the peoples, the native peoples, who have lived in isolation and not mixed with more modern races. Yeah. Anyone else here?
Are all colored races of people, yellow, black, red, descendants of Ham?
No. It depends on the regions of the world in which they initially settled. A lot of the families of Ham would have had the coloration, if you will, of the Mediterranean peoples, the same complexion as the Greeks and southern Italians and others. And of the race of Japheth in India, as well as in other places where they settled into those more equatorial climes, we have people of very dark skin who have the racial heritage of Japheth. They don't have, for example, the African features, the kind of lips and nose and so forth that went along with that climate, that of the southern Africans and so forth. But we have people of dark skin who come from Semitic heritage, people of dark skin who come from Japheth's heritage. Skin tone doesn't tell you who your ancestor was. Anyone else? Up here.
We have good old Nimrod's representation every December the 25th in the Christmas tree that we have. You know, the legend was that his mother thought he was going to be immortal, and that a tree represents him. And the heathen thought that the coniferous tree was a good symbol, and we have glommed onto that ourselves, so that okay. We have it with us today.
And I haven't made that specific connection, but there is associated with Marduk the idea of the mother and the child, and a lot of festivals, a lot of rituals of the ancient idolatrous world centered on that mother and child relationship, which comes into the Western world with the Madonna and child, very much a part of Western culture as adopted into Roman Catholicism with the Madonna and child imagery. But that is part of the Marduk mythology from Babylon, which, again, if we associate Marduk with Nimrod, would be associated with Nimrod. And there's no doubt, because of that early beginning at Babel, that Nimrod had a religious agenda. There's no doubt that he had had the idea of redefining religion as a way of consolidating power, I think. I said no doubt, and then I said I think, so there you go.
Just to clarify what I'd said earlier, you're thinking then that even though they knew at one time how to work with metal, that by the time of King Saul, they no longer knew?
Well, there is a vast difference between being a goldsmith and being an ironsmith. And they never had I don't think they had the ironsmithing technology when they came out of Egypt. I don't recall anything about that. And the iron smithing technology is something that would have been new to Canaan entirely, not just to the Israelites, but to Canaan entirely, and in the hands of the Phoenicians who brought it down from Anatolia, the Iron Age, as it's referred to.
Okay. Yeah, just reading the verse in the Bible, it sounds like the Philistines were controlling that, as though they could have let them have their blacksmiths, but they didn't.
Well, any technology can be learned. As you know, I mean, what have we learned in America that hasn't been either sold or stolen by someone else? Technology is always available to those who want to master it and want to learn it. And the Philistines kept a tight lid on that because they didn't want the Israelites to learn that.
Another point, do you think that we're seeing the same Tower of Babel spirit today and that it's been throughout history? If you're not a stranger and a pilgrim on earth, you're going with the Tower of Babel, where you're organizing and trying to unite the whole world.
I think there is always a certain spirit of wanting either some particular power wanting to dominate the world, or people wanting to bring everyone together in some sort of a system, some sort of New Age idea of one world system. And I mean, we hear that kind of language from people who are in powerful political positions, powerful economic positions, and some of the organizations that were founded in the 20th century certainly seem to lend themselves to trying to bring the whole world under one homogenous isn't really the right word there, but government. And it's one of those things that, you know, you kind of can speculate about, but the scriptures aren't really clear about anything like that ever happening again. I have my doubts that God's going to allow that to ever happen again, that before that would, but maybe I'm reading it wrong. Maybe that is going to happen, and it's going to be one of the things that brings about that final press that causes God to call the final trumpet.
So gathering the nations.
Gathering the nations, yeah.
It seems to be a competition to Christ's purpose to gather everyone together in one in Christ.
Right. Yeah, one of the reasons that I don't look to that in the sense of a sign, and I know you're not proposing it as such, is that, you know, Paul and the other writers of the New Testament keep saying to us, you know, he's going to come like a thief. You're not going to know when he's going to come, and live as though he's going to come today or tomorrow. And consequently, I'm not anticipating, and this was referred to, Ann Dennis actually made the comment, and I can't quote the comment she made, but it was a comment to the effect that this may happen before the end, and you said, well, don't count on it, and that's right. There may be a one-world government before the end, but don't count on it. Don't be thinking, well, I've got until, you know, the one-world government forms before the Lord's going to come again. Don't be thinking that way. Because there may be a one-world consensus that has nothing to do with political power. There may be a worldwide consensus against Christ that has nothing to do with political organizations, or very little to do with specific political coming together. And when I read of the gathering of the nations against the city of God and the people of God, I don't necessarily anticipate that that's going to be a physical attack. It may be a physical attack, an effort to finally stamp out the Christian faith from the face of the earth. But that attack may come in other ways besides violence, or in other ways in conjunction with violence. I don't know. Okay?
Yeah, just to kind of throw some validation to Tom's point, it wasn't too many months ago. I think it was a Jehovah's Witness stopped by my house around lunch and was trying to use a verse in Daniel, you know, to convey the idea that we're moving toward one kingdom.
There certainly are people, and people of great power and influence, who would desire to have the whole world under one judgment system, one government system, one law system, and then there are those of us who think that that would really be pretty ugly. No matter how benevolent the intentions, that thing about power corrupting, yeah, it's real. Anyone else? One more. This will be our last comment or question.
It's a question, and it probably isn't really related to anything, but I've heard I've heard the theory that Nimrod might have, when it says he was a great hunter, and since this is so close to the flood, just the whole idea of dinosaurs and then the Leviathan and everything mentioned later, that he might have been a dragon slayer. Do you know if there's any other verses that might relate to that or not really? Or?
Well, only if you want to look at verses like those that talk about Leviathan and Behemoth and something like that. But yeah, of course, that's speculative, and it may be, for all I know. I don't have any way of knowing what the hunting referred to specifically, because we're not given specifics here. But the prowess of hunting great beasts has been a sign of the authority, the sign of the power of many another king besides Nimrod. And the greater the beast, the greater the power, right? One thing to bear in mind, and I've mentioned this before, is that post-flood world in those hundreds of years following the flood was a pretty wild place. Very desolate, not sparsely populated, not populated. And the animals were turned loose into that to reproduce themselves. And they did. You know, they scattered and reproduced like they were supposed to. And while a lot of our Japhethite ancestors were struggling to survive in a difficult climate, these Hamites and Semites were living in that nice tropical, semi-tropical, that relatively benign climate of the Fertile Crescent and flourishing. But the world, a lot of the world was a very tough place in those days for quite a while. And it became a real challenge to fill the earth as they did. We're going to stop there, and I took back 2 of the minutes that you had yesterday. So be ready again, and settle down in here by 10:30.